her bones, but she'd said it was the bump to Maud's head that concerned her most, that Maud might never wake. That did not stop us from sitting at her bedside, waiting for her to do so. Come on, Castor. Rory reached for Benji's arm. I'll take you to your room. Sleep off some of that wine. Benji pulled away. Fucking hell, Rory, leave me alone! No one believes this white knight charade. Rory flinched. I flew to my feet, but it was the gargoyle who spoke. That is unkind and unworthy, Bartholomew. He'd been quietly crying in the corner of the room, and now appeared the spirit of righteous anger. If you value your friend when he fights your battles for you, when he is rogue and ruthless, you must value him when he is gentle too. Otherwise you do not value him at all. Benji leaned his back against the bed, put his hands over his face. I'm sorry, Rory. Rory was looking at Maud's unmoving form, his dark eyes glassy. It's fine. Hours later, in the quiet of the hall, I was thinking of Maud, of the diviners, of sleep that brooked no awakening. Next to me, the gargoyle was looking out the window at the chiming wood.
The whole world is a wood, Bartholomew, and everyone in it is fashioned of birch bark, frail as paper.
He began to cry, and I did too. Oh, gargoyle. I used to think his sadness, his heavy emotion, such a futile thing, an irreconcilable flaw. But as I kept to Maud's room, watching Benji drink, and Rory go silent, and feeling my own tongue struggle to put to words the defeat I felt, I began to think I'd been telling myself the wrong story about my peculiar, bat-like gargoyle. Sadness, like birch bark, had all the appearance of frailty. And yet, the tree prevailed. A day later, I was running down the stairs, bare feet slapping against stone. When I found the gargoyle, polishing armor in the great hall, I was breathless. She's awake! Maud was sitting up in bed, drinking water, pale and shaky and covered in bandages, but awake. I stepped into the room, and she looked at me with those kind green eyes, and I learned that, for all my heartbreak over death, over false stories and lying gods and lifeless diviners, my heart could break for happiness, too. Hey, Maud! Heard you two snagged that chime, she said, winking at the gargoyle. That's four omens down. Two more to go. Her voice grew solemn. I know things have not been anything like you thought they'd be when you left Ashling, Diviner. But I hope you know how special you are to us. We wouldn't have gotten this far without you. Oh, I scrubbed a hand over my cheek. Thank you. I'm very glad you're not, you know.
Dead as a door hanger,
the gargoyle offered. Maud turned to Benji, who stood near the window. We should do something to commemorate her. She's been fearless. Benji's skin was brighter, his eyes less glassy. Maud's awakening had brought him back to himself. Whatever sounds good to you, Maud. I was thinking a knighthood. We'll have a proper ceremony. Today. I didn't know what to say. Don't knights swear to the omens in their vows? We can skip that part. Maud beamed. You don't have to do it, of course. But just in case you've grown tired of Ashling's creed and everything that's come with it, you might like to say ours for a while. My armor may dent, my sword may break, but I will never diminish. I knew what she was doing, offering me a permanent place now that the diviners were gone, telling me that I need not remain adrift, that I had a home with them if I wanted one. Tears prickled behind my eyes. I'm not noble born.
Exceptions can be made, Rory and Maud said at the same time, sharing a smile, then sending it my way.
Benji's gaze shifted between Rory and me. He was quiet. Then, Six has proven helpful as a diviner. I wouldn't want to change her title. The influence she wields, the way the nobles look at me when I'm with her.
Don't be a prat, Rory said. This isn't about you.
Of course it's not. Benji's cheeks reddened, his voice hardening. I'm the king, and it's never about me. I'm not respected like a craftsman, or a knight, or a diviner. My first public act is to go into the hamlets and be utterly humiliated by the nobility in the names of the omens. I know that I'm young, and that my grandfather was a heretic, but the treatment of sovereigns goes far beyond that. It's as if my position has only ever existed to be a foil to Aisling. I am made a prostrate fool to prove how much weaker a king is to a god.
The silence in the room was heavy. Rory went to stand in front of Benji. When he slouched, as he often did, Rory and the king stood exactly equal, eye to eye.
Perhaps that's the system's fatal flaw. If Aisling and the omens have only ever painted a king as inconsequential, what does it say about them if a king is the one who brings them all down?
Benji's face twisted as he held back tears.
Your grandfather would be proud of you, Benji. Maud, despite her bandages, tried to sit up straighter.
We're proud too.
I nodded in agreement, and the gargoyle leaned close to whisper in my ear.
If the boy wants to make me cry, he'll need a sadder story than that.
I shushed him, and the king's gaze turned. Benji looked at me, really looked at me. I couldn't see the world behind his eyes, but I was certain it was vast, and that he was desperate to map it.
If you wish it, Six, of course I'll knight you. Your loyalty is a treasure I would never deny.
He stepped around Rory, placing himself between us. But please understand, our work is not yet done. Every omen that dies, every stone object I claim, I grow closer to reclaiming the kingdom from its dreams and portents and false stories. But if I succeed in taking up the mantle, if the omens are vanquished, if Aisling falls, I must give people something to believe in their stead. All that power has to go somewhere.
He took my hand, then turned to Maud, then Rory.
Do you all promise to be there with me? That I might bear it?
Of course, Benji, Maud said. We're with you.
Rory nodded, his gaze flickering to me. My business has ever been with the omens, I murmured. Next, it will be with the Heartsaw Weaver. And after, my voice hardened, with the Moth. When I face the Abyss again, it will be in armor, not gossamer. I reached out, took Benji's hand, with King Benedict Castor III at my side. He smiled, boyish, brave.
Then let's get you knighted.
The gargoyle and I stood outside Betula Hall's library door at sunset. Maud had chosen it for the knighting, because that was where the best western light shone, and she said she liked the feel of it on her cheek. The rest of the knights were not there, and I was glad for it. I didn't want a display. It was only me, the gargoyle, Maud, Benji, Rory, and the blacksmith, Victor, who'd brought me my finished suit of armor that morning. It was so beautiful. I didn't even remember the names of all the pieces, but the gargoyle, who had not shirked his duty as squire, had chattered in my ear about them as he dressed me. When the chainmail, then armor, was fastened, I felt like a great stone edifice, sturdy and impenetrable, but with a beating, swelling heart within.
You know, Bartholomew, the gargoyle said, just before we joined the others in the library, it would be all right if you did not want to become a knight.
I turned. What makes you say that?
I don't know why I say the things I do.
I'd given him my hammer and chisel to hold. He weighed them in his palms, his brows lowering in contemplation.
Only, you did not ask to become a diviner. yet you swore all your worth to Aisling. It would be a sad story were you to do that again."
His stone eyes rose to my face.
"But if you wanted to, I would not blame you. It is easier swearing ourselves to someone else's cause than to sit with who we are without one."
With that, he stepped forward, humming to himself, and pushed open the library doors. Benji and Maud and Rory stood by the west windows of the library, lit by a sunset sky. Maud was not wearing armour on account of her bandages, but Rory and Benji had donned full suits, the metal bright, reflecting the day's final light. They watched me as I came into the library, offering the moment the stillness it was due. Rory's gaze warmed my face, and I met it, wishing with a sudden intensity that he knew I was looking back at him, that my shroud was not there between us. When I stood before them, next to the gargoyle, light fell upon our faces in a way it never had in the spring upon Aisling's chancel. The king drew an arming sword from his belt, cleared his throat.
"I am Benedict Castor III.
His voice was quiet at first, but then I smiled at him, and he spoke louder, projecting over the library, like we were in a vast hall filled with witnesses.
"It is my honour, for deeds done in bravery, in shrewdness, and in generosity of heart, to bestow the title of knight upon..."
"Sybil," I said. "My name is Sybil Delling." Benji's gaze widened, and Maud's smile lit the room. Rory watched me with soft eyes, and the gargoyle began to clap, then sob.
"Bravo, Bartholomew! Bravo!"
The king took a moment to speak. "Very well. Sybil Delling, do you accept the accolade of knighthood?"
"Yes."
"Bend a knee."
I did.
"A knight's craft is love, faith, war. Now, because the knights are not here, I will not swear you to the same vows of faith we three took. There will be no talk of the omens, no self-effacement. Rather, I will put upon you the weight of responsibility due to the valorous of the Stonewater Kingdom, and you will tell me if you agree to its burden."
He did not seem like such a boy anymore, his spine straighter, his words surer.
"Does that suit you?"
"It does." Next to him, Maud was grinning ear to ear. I wondered how many ceremonies she'd been to. How many times, since girlhood, she'd watched a knighting. Yet I knew, by the happy lines in her face, it meant something to her, being here for mine.
"Do you vow to protect the weak and defenceless, and all those who beckon for your aid?"
Benji asked.
"I do."
"Do you vow to be a witness, pupil, and visitor to the kingdom's peoples, and keep peace within the hamlets?"
"I do."
"Do you swear to reject pecuniary reward and all mercenary endeavours, acting only upon charity and what best suits the kingdom?"
"Yes."
"Do you swear loyalty to the crown, to be my serving knight, and also my diviner?"
I paused. My shroud was so much lighter than my armour, but I felt its weight upon me. What is a diviner, really, when nothing is divine?
"You needn't wear the title if it no longer fits you," Rory murmured. "You needn't do anything you do not wish to."
The king's gaze shot to him.
"Yes, she does. That's the whole point. To swear to me is to swear to my wishes, my aspirations, my kingship. If she vows to be my knight, she vows devotion, to do as I ask, just as you and Maud have."
His eyes darted to me, then back to Rory.
"Yes? Yes," Rory snapped. "We swore loyalty, but not mindlessness. She's not here to give up more of her liberty, Benedict. The Abbess did not own her diviners, the omens do not own Traum, and you do not own the Stonewater Kingdom, nor your knights, just for some words said in a ceremony."
"That's not..." Benji flushed. "You've never seen the importance, the virtue, of noble vows." A deathly calm came over Rory.
Because I'm neither noble nor virtuous.
Maud rubbed her brow as if she were watching two siblings squabble over a toy. Wrong time, wrong place. This armor fits me better than my divining robe ever did, I said abruptly. It's an honor to wear it. I reached up, grazed the rim of my shroud. But I've sworn to Aisling, and I've sworn to the omens, and I've sworn to my friends who are now forever gone. I drew in a long breath. I think I would like to stop promising myself away, or else there will be nothing left of me to give, King Castor.
A fine answer, Bartholomew, the gargoyle commended.
Benji's cheeks were still red. He turned away from Rory. Fine. The king lowered the arming sword to my left shoulder, then my right.
Sybil Delling, your armor may dent, your sword may break, but may you never diminish.
He looked upon my shroud, searching for my eyes, but he could not find me.
Welcome to my knighthood.
Hours later, when the moon was high, the gargoyle snoring and Maud lost to sleeping draughts, rest was a stranger. I wandered Petula Hall, still in my armor. I thought maybe I'd check in on Benji, but when I ambled past his door, my feet kept moving, taking me where I needed to go. The door I stopped at had no light dancing under its threshold to invite me. Still, I knocked three times against the wood. No one answered. I pressed my brow upon the aged grain. Mendacious? Again, no answer. Maybe he was asleep. But just as I was about to go, Sybil. I breathed against the door, clasped the cold iron knob, turned it. Rory was seated upon a long bed, a weary candle lit upon an adjacent table. He wasn't in his armor anymore, just a pale shirt and trousers. His elbows rested on his knees, his hands dropped between his legs, fingers flexing as I stepped into the room.
Are you all right?
I closed the door behind me. I just wanted... He waited. I just wanted to see you. His throat hitched. Then, come here. The candle caught my visage, casting a long shadow upon the floor. I stepped into the room, walking until there were no more steps to take, until my armored toes were pointed at Rory's bare ones. Slowly, my hand dropped onto his black hair, my fingers tangling in the silken mess. He looked up, gravel in his voice.
You're still in your armor.
I didn't let the gargoyle take it off.
Why?
I feel stronger with it on. Rory held me in his gaze. I thought he might lecture me on martyrdom or strength, on the impossible weight of living. He rose to his feet instead, put his hands to my face, held my cheeks with an imploring pressure.
What happens at Aisling Cathedral is not your fault. The omens and the terrible things they've done are not your fault. Lost diviners, past and present, are not your fault. You have no failures or falsehoods to amend for, no vows to tether you, no strength to prove.
He soothed my hair, as if to comb away the knots of my despair.
Especially to me.
My body had always been strong, and ever just enough, but whatever my soul was made of was frail, like birch bark, like gossamer, like the wings of a moth. When Rory brought his lips to my forehead, kissing it with unbearable softness, speaking the language of pain and reprieve into me, that frail little soul began to fortify. It's heavy, I murmured. My armor.
I know.
He took a step back, eyes dropping to my mouth.
Let me help you.
He began with my pauldrons. Clasps were undone, armored plates removed first from my shoulders, then arms. Rory released my hands from their gauntlets. Next came my breastplate. When that had joined the pile of armor upon the floor, Rory dropped to his knees and began to work the clasps at my thighs, the cuisses, the polanes. The greaves upon my shins fell with a clang, and then it was just the intricate web of plates, the sabaton over my boots. Rory discarded them all, then removed my boots too. When he looked up at me from his knees, it was the same way I'd looked up while being knighted. There wasn't a sword between us, but he was just as vulnerable as I'd been. When the armor was off, Rory rose to his feet. Sit on the bed. The backs of my legs hit the mattress. I sat, and Rory's eyelids grew heavy. Arms up. He grasped my chainmail at my ribs, the web of iron hissing as he pulled it. By slow measures, it shifted. When it finally surrendered and fell to the floor, Rory and I were both breathing hard. My armor lay like a vanquished enemy at our feet, just like in the fervent peaks when I'd moved through the hot spring's feverish water. I felt weightless. I rose to my feet. All of it. Rory's gaze trailed up the buttons of my under armor, his brow knitting as he searched for more armor that wasn't there. I took his hand and brought it up my body, over my stomach, my ribs, up my throat, and onto my cheek, until his fingers, rough and calloused, caught on my shroud. "This too," I whispered. His muscles tensed, Rory's entire body suddenly called to attention. "Sybil, I'll wear it publicly, like Benji wants, prove that I am influential, mythical, fearsome. Only..." He kept still, waiting for me to finish. "Only I don't think those things matter to me anymore." I stepped closer, our faces inches apart. "Please, Rory, take it off. I want someone to see me." I whispered against his lips. "I want it to be you." Rory's touch was slow, gentle. He slid his pointer finger under my shroud, grazing my cheekbone, the delicate line of my lower lashes. We both let out a shaking breath. I guided his hand over my cheek, behind my ear, to the knot at the back of my head. Rory worked it, keeping his eyes on my face the entire time. The candle's meager light cast shadows over him, his dark eyes two pools of ink. They trailed over my cheeks, my nose, over my lips once, twice. The knot loosened. I reached out of instinct, pinning my shroud to my cheek before it could fall. Rory's hand went still. "You can change your mind." I let go. "I haven't." Rory's lips parted, but he didn't say anything. His fingers got back to work on the knot. It loosened, and then my shroud was falling, silent, onto the pile of armor. I didn't watch it drop. My eyes remained lifted, fixed in the darkness of Rory's. His inhale was sharp. For an excruciating moment, I couldn't read his face, couldn't decipher his eyes. "What?" His breaths came faster. "I don't think I have the words." "Am I that unsightly?" His thumb found my chin, lifted it. He looked so exquisite to me. My shroud had never hidden any of his beauty, nor was I surprised to see it so close. Roderick Mendacious was exquisite. But it wasn't that. It was the newness of his expression. There was wonder in his gaze I'd never glimpsed before, as if seeing my eyes for the first time had profoundly altered his. He said it intently, like he was imploring every part of me to take heed.
"You're the most beautiful woman I've ever seen, Sybil Delling."
The air tasted of him, of musk and idleweed, and the distinct smell of his sweat. I breathed it in too fast, filled my mouth and lungs with it, but it wasn't enough. The darkness in Rory's gaze blew wide. There was no kneeling, no wearing armor. We stood nigh eye to eye, perfectly balanced, he naked in his wonder, me in my defenselessness, and both of us in our desire. Don't tell me what they look like. I pressed onto my toes, swallowed his shaking breath with my own. Don't say anything at all. Rory smeared his thumb across my lips. I'll do anything you ask of me. And then his mouth was on mine. Chapter 25. Unraveling. He gave me 30 seconds, a heady half minute where I was certain I was the master of Roderick Mendacious. No sooner had our mouths collided than a moan, deep and tortured, resonated up Rory's throat. His fingers were in my shirt, catching in the fabric, pulling it until my front was flush with his. Heat emanated from his body like he was the sun. I wanted to run my mouth up his stomach, see if he'd burn my tongue. But for now, my focus was on his lips, on dragging my own against them, on the taste, on the dance of tongues. The sounds coming out of him, gods, ragged breaths that rasped louder when I pressed my teeth into his bottom lip. I kissed Rory madly, drove my hand through his hair, slammed my body against his until there was nothing but the fabric of our shirts between us. It wasn't enough. I threw my leg over his hip, letting out a surprised noise of pleasure to feel the hardness of him. Rory seemed to remember himself then, his hands, the earthly plane he was tethered to. And suddenly it became abundantly clear, for all the times I'd thrown him down, just how badly he wanted to return the favor. He caught me beneath the thighs, fingertips pressing into my bottom like he wanted to brand himself there. He broke our kiss to look me in the eyes, to smirk, and then he was lifting me off my feet like I weighed nothing, walking us back, and throwing me down onto his bed. The momentum sent the weary candle flickering, then snuffed it out altogether, leaving nothing but a trail of smoke. The only light in the room now was the quarter moon, hovering in the window. My shirt was rucked up around my ribs. I reached under its hem, hooked a finger in my trousers, dragged them off my legs until I was bare. Rory stood at the edge of the bed, waylaid by the sight of me. His eyelids lowered to half-mast, and the sight of his unveiled desire made me even bolder. I sat up on my elbows, held his eyes, reached for my shirt, undid its clasps one by one. I'd never been entirely naked in front of anyone before, not the diviners, not the abbess, not even in my dreams. I'd always worn the shield, the anonymity of my shroud, save once, when I dreamed of the moth. Rory did what I asked of him. He didn't say anything at all, the room silent but for our heavy breathing. I felt it in my body when my tunic fell away and he saw me entirely bare, felt it when his eyes, awestruck and obsidian black, roved the length of me. When the air grew heated, taut. Your turn. Rory took his lacing in a fist, ripped it free. When he shrugged out of his shirt, muscles bunching, my gaze was an eager traveller. It trailed down his neck, over the lines of his abdomen, down to his navel. Down the dark trail of hair that disappeared into his pants. He looked just like he had the night we'd first met, half naked, a mess of sweat and ungodly good looks, Only now, derision had been mastered by desire. I bit my lip, nodded at his pants. Those two. His thumb dipped into the waist of his pants. Rory held my eyes, grinned, then took his thumb back out. You're teasing me. He shrugged. Not very knightly of you. His eyelids lowered. Hmm. I pressed upright onto my palms. What if I took them off for you? I pulled my legs beneath me, pushed up, got on my knees. His entire body flexed. The sound of air rushing out of his mouth was profane. I reached for his pants. It happened fast. One moment I was on my knees, and the next, Rory's hands were under my arms, lifting me, putting me once more onto my back. He crawled over me, breaking his promise of silence only once. First, you unravel, he rasped against my ear, then pressed me into his pillows with a ferocious kiss. And I thought I must be the stupidest woman alive, that I had spent so much time fighting with him, when I could have been fighting with his lips instead. Rory liked it. Kissing. I could tell. He cupped my jaw, fingertips pressing into my cheeks, making my lips pucker for him. He kissed me wetly, worshipfully, and I was gasping. I tried to put all my eager sounds back behind the wall of my teeth, but Rory seemed to know I was made tense, denying myself, denying him, because his focus drifted from my mouth to my jaw, as if to soften it with kisses. He kissed the column of my throat, then roved over affected skin, the bite marks the ardent oarsman had left, those he paid particular attention to. Like his wet inner lip, his tongue could undo the violence the omen had tended me. Like he wanted more than to merely kill gods, he wanted to cleanse me of them. Yes, Rory liked kissing. Or maybe he just liked kissing me. Pressing his forehead over my sternum, he laid his mouth over my breasts, kissed and sighed over them. I rolled my hips, ran my pelvis over his, heard the rush of his breath. I did that again, then once more, imagining us as knights, sparring in a yard, sweaty and fighting, pressing and grunting in the dirt. Mendacious. I felt his lips curl into a smile over my left breast. He kissed it, nipped it. My voice was strangled. If you don't bed me now, I'm going to scream. He raised himself, looked me over. Hair fell in errant waves over his brow, and his mouth was swollen. Even in the dim light, I could see his pulse racing in his neck, hear the ragged intake of his breaths. He looked halfway to satisfaction, prolonging mine. And that realization. In the siege. My hand found his shoulders, drawing him up closer. Just before you measured me for armor, when you sparred in the yard, dirty and unbridled. I wrapped my legs around his waist, put my mouth over that thrumming pulse in his neck. You looked so ignoble. I sucked his skin, pressed my teeth into it, said, almost frantic, I thought I'd die if I couldn't have you. Rory made a tormented sound, took me by the nape of the neck and hauled me onto his lap. I straddled him, legs swung around his hips. We sat eye to eye, and for a frayed moment did nothing but breathe. I was unguarded without my shroud, split wide open beneath his gaze, like a limestone beneath a hammer. Rory held me tightly, grasping the nape of my neck with one hand, while the other drifted down my spine in a long, devoted caress. All the while, he kept his eyes on mine, held them with the same care he tended my body. And that obliterated a keystone in my wall. I take it back. I raked my fingers through his hair. Say something. Say anything. There was only one fitting thing. Rory kissed me in a way no story can properly express. Sybil. He pressed me with both hands, fingers weaving into my hair and also low over my bottom. Whatever it was that made you sigh in your room that night after the hot spring, I've thought about it too. I've thought about it 1,000 times. He squeezed the flesh of my backside. I've thought about your thighs, how they felt when I measured them for armor, what it would be like putting my mouth between them. His hand withdrew, then snapped back, a quick smack across my bottom that made us both moan. I've thought about your voice. I've stayed up, thinking about it, wondering if it would be sharp or soft when I made you come. His throat worked. I've thought such unknightly things. I was panting, and so was he. You could walk over me, Sybil Delling. Throw me down until I am dust. I don't know what to call it, but I want it. I want you. I ran my bareness over him, watched him lose his sight for desire. So have me. He did not prolong my pleasure a second longer. Rory let go of my bottom, reached between our trembling bodies, pressed his middle finger against my sex. I gasped, and he swallowed the sound like it fed him. I looked down at his glistening hand between my legs, watched, felt, as he slid 1, 2 fingers into me. He let out a bass noise when he saw just how eager I was and looked up to my eyes, waiting as he always did. I nodded, and he trailed his fingers up over sensitive skin, circled it, gave me a sharp jolt, then dragged an arduously slow path back to their home within me. I was a chime, and he was sounding me again, again, again. There were no more gods to call out to, but, oh my gods, the room was fracturing, the bed, the window, the moon through it, all of them fracturing. I cried out, grasped Rory's face, come with me. He shifted his hips from beneath me, and suddenly, after spinning me like a slow burning wax, he was in a hurry. He shoved his pants down, and I clawed them off his thighs, pleased beyond measure to run my fingers through his leg hair, over his hips, his length. Rory hissed out a breath, lifted me over his lap, nudged my entrance. His pupils were blown wide. Tell me yes, right now. No litany, no profanity was better than hearing him this desperate. Yes. He drew me down, down, down. I let out a reckless sound, and his grip at the nape of my neck tightened. We collided, flesh to flesh, pulse against pulse, eye to eye. And I forgot everything. I forgot looming tors and scholarly cities, jagged mountains, outlandish woods, and everyone within them. All I really knew was fullness, painful pleasure, the look in Rory's eyes as he moved in me, the tender insistence of his fingers between us, circling, stroking. Something was building, taking wing. Every time Rory pressed into me, I felt it stir. We were going slow, so lavishly slow. But I was losing my breath, and suddenly I was unsure. If I can't, if I don't finish...
You don't have to do anything.
Rory's eyes were hazy. He pulled his hand out from between us, put his thumb over my bottom lip, over the edges of my teeth, over my tongue, like he had once at Ashling, like I had to him in the wood. There was no blood this time, just sweat, and the faint hint of our desires.
"This isn't a spectacle or a ceremony," he said. "It's just you and me, Sybil."
He didn't like being away from my mouth. Every word was punctuated with a kiss.
"I just want you to feel good."
I bloomed, light and heavy at once. Lips parting, breasts heaving, heart swelling, body clenching, my blood twisted, then became mightily scattered. It was like a dream. I was falling, falling. Rory. Whatever flesh was there, his shoulder, his mouth, I bit into it, anchored myself to it. Rory. I unraveled until I was the barest spool of thread, spinning in the wake of the little death.
Fuck.
Rory thrust harder, faster. He moaned, stealing the air from the room, from me. He was undone, holding even harder to my backside, saying my name, moving in and out of me, unbridled. He pulled out of me just in time, pressed me down over his mattress, spilled himself over my stomach, my breasts. Rory panted, and I, like a cathedral, echoed him. Our eyes caught, and he smiled, then fell to my side. He cleaned me off with his fallen shirt and pulled me against him, put one hand in my hair and lazed the other over my backside. And I thought, blood slowing, eyelids growing heavy, breath idling. Maybe contentedness isn't just a story. When I woke, heavy as lead, the moon was still a lanky presence in the sky. I hadn't remembered drifting off, only the heat of Rory's body pressed against mine, the feel of his chest rising, falling, the smell of his skin. I sat up. The bed, the mattress, just like when one had vanished, was bereft of warmth. Rory was gone. The only heartbeat in the room was mine. Rory? No answer. I suddenly felt cold. I reached for the edge of the bed, found my shroud. It felt rougher than I remembered. I held it out and examined it. Strange that something so light, so thin, might hold dominion over me. I hadn't yet taken in the breadth of Rory's room. My eyes hadn't strayed once from him. But now that he was gone, I cast my eyes over the space. It was little wonder he'd lost his mind when I told him back at Ashling that I didn't have any possessions to bring along. The room was brimming with effects. Were Rory's bedroom a ship, it would sink for the weight of its cargo. The shelves were laden. I could smell leather and idleweed, wool, parchment. There were books, clay vases full of rolled leaflets and quills with broken nibs, clothes that looked to be from each of the five hamlets, crates of yarn, then smaller ones filled with gold and brass trinkets. I couldn't discern rhyme or reason, only abundance. Something on a corner table caught my eye, a looking glass, a fine one set in silver. I went to it, fingers tightening over the cold handle. I lifted it slowly, the journey to my own reflection arduous. I saw my face bereft of gossamer, pale skin and a flushed, swollen mouth, silver eyebrows and hair unkempt, a slightly crooked nose, eyes. My breath went out. Because of all the lies the abbess had told me at Ashling, all her falsehoods regarding signs and gods, there was one truth hidden among them. I had been forever changed by drowning in the spring upon the chancel. The eyes I looked upon were not the eyes of a young woman. They were not the eyes of a human at all. They were pallid, white, completely bereft of iris or pupil, like those of an unpainted statue, hewn entirely of stone, just like an omen. I dropped the looking glass onto the table and fumbled for my shroud. The chamber door opened. Rory was there, in poorly fastened pants, holding a tray. There was a pitcher, bread, and berries upon it. I froze, and so did he.
You look like you've just robbed me.
His eyes fell over my naked body, and I heard his breath leave him. But then his gaze snagged on the shroud in my hand, then the looking glass, still wobbling on the table. His foot swung back, and the chamber door slammed shut.
What's wrong?
I look like a monster. My fingers twisted in my shroud. I turned to his shelves, my voice shaking. Your room is an impressive collection of everything. Rory said nothing, the line of his shoulders drawing tight. Where did you get it all? It took him a moment to speak.
I never had anything, he said. Not at Pupil House 2 and not in Corson Fair. The Artful Brigand, he thought it funny, denying me basic necessities in a place as opulent as Castle Lurik.
He touched the three gold rings in his ear.
Benji's grandfather gave me these. They were the first things I ever truly owned. But even when I was out from the brigand's yoke and Maud's squire, my hands felt empty, so I tried to fill them. A bad habit, I know.
I realized with a sinking stomach that his pause was for shame. He thought that I was looking down at him.
I assumed Maud would beat me, or at the very least, dismiss me when she found out I was a thief. She fit me with armor instead. Said fingers were not so light when clasped by gauntlets.
Rory's voice quieted. She looked out for me, even pulled the weight of her family name that I might be knighted. He nodded at his shelves.
I've paid for these, or replaced them with something of value. It took time, and the habit's hard to kick, but I went back and paid.
I don't care that you steal things, Rory. His shoulders eased a whit, but his gaze remained strained.
Then why are you looking at me differently?
How could you say I was beautiful? My whisper was a horrible rasp. My eyes. I'm like them. It took him a moment to catch up. When he did, his face was a charming conflict of relief and concern.
It's Aisling's spring water, he said. You've been swallowing it for ages.
I didn't want to look at him. I guessed they'd be horrible, that they might be stone, that dreaming and drowning had altered me in some vital way. When the ardent oarsman knocked off my helmet and glimpsed them, he dropped his guard, like he couldn't fathom what he was seeing. My chest was heavy. Maybe he couldn't believe, beneath gossamer, that a diviner and an omen were not so different. Rory's throat hitched, and his voice hardened, like he was trying to steel me with his assuredness.
You're nothing like them, Sybil.
I needed to know. I'll never be able to see myself clearly if it is ever through Aisling's shroud. But knowing you'd seen my eyes and had left the room, I thought maybe you'd changed your mind about me, that you were repulsed or regretful. Rory was across the room in a moment. His tray hit the table with a raucous clatter, and he ripped the shroud from my hands, tossing it onto the floor. He kissed me, hard.
You don't like me when I'm a good knight, he said over my lips, and you don't like me when I'm bad.
I let out a startled laugh, nodding at the mess of blankets upon his bed. Evidence to the contrary. He grinned against my skin, then withdrew to look into my eyes.
You are beautiful, Sybil Delling, So fucking beautiful. You're strong and smart and noble. He grasped the nape of my neck, and I wondered if he liked to touch me there because he could aim my gaze. But I think I like it best when you're wrong. I shook my head, but I was a poor player at derision. I smiled. I left to get us food. Another kiss, this time on my cheek. I haven't changed my mind about anything. Another, on my neck. I'm so far the opposite of repulsed or regretful about you that I'm lost. Rory took my hand, put my finger to his lips. Don't go. The moon shone over us, just a young man and a young woman standing together, a strange sacrality between us that had nothing to do with portents or Ashling Cathedral or omens. I want to keep looking at you, he murmured into my knuckles, all night. And the rules? My pulse was a torrid rush. The knighthood bans bed relations. You said so yourself.
I never said anything like that.
I pulled his hair. Rory slouched forward, smiling.
It's not a vow, just an arbitrary rule. Fuck the rules, Sybil.
His eyelids grew heavy.
Fuck me, and fuck the rules.
We unraveled all night long. We lost our gods, our armor, our own names. We spent ourselves on each other, completely and utterly vanishing into the craft of desire. Completely, utterly gone. The Cliffs of Belladine. Loomstone. Only love, only heartbreak, can weave the thread of all that came and all that is yet to come. Chapter 26. You Can Never Go Home. I didn't want the rest of the world to see my stone eyes. Not yet. I wore my shroud and my armor when we rode out of the Chiming Wood to the fifth and final hamlet, the Cliffs of Belladine, where the Heartsore Weaver dwelled with her magic loomstone. Not all the knights rode with us. Several stayed to assist the folk of the wood with the reconstruction of their sacred glen after the sprite attack. A memorial for Eleanor Eichel would be built, the glen cleansed of blood and the remains of the Birka. Benji paid 80 gold coins of his own money to see it done. Good of him to do that, I said to Maud, settling her bandaged body into a cart for travel. Behind me, someone chuckled. Hamelin was there, saddling the horse to our wagon. I walked over. What's so funny? Nothing, only... He smiled, like he was telling a joke I was not in on. Benedict's hamlet is Coulson Fair. He's taken it to heart, that creed. The only god of men is coin. He handed the reins to the cart driver, then left to find his own horse. Folk of the wood came to watch us go, many dropping their hoods, pressing their axes to their chests in salute, to see Maud go by. Mouths turned, faces drawn by adoration and reverence lining the road. Tales of her bravery abounding, the awestruck words, Sprite Killer, echoing through the trees as we rode out of the Chiming Wood. She was in pain. That was why she preferred the cart and not her horse. The morning surrendered to day, and while the roll of the cart wheels and the wind in the trees and even the off-tune hum of the gargoyle was a soothing lull, Maud could not get comfortable, twisting and wincing in her seat. How do you feel? I asked. In truth? She was looking up at the trees, the fingers of her uninjured hand idling over her axe. Like a fool. You'll heal, Maud. You'll get better, and you'll be useful again and not feel so helpless. She put up a hand, stopping me. If I was fixed on being the most useful version of myself, she gestured at her bandages, it would be all too easy to hate my body when it was not. I don't. People who love you for your usefulness don't love you at all.
Her words shamed me. Then why do you feel like a fool? She sighed. Because my mother killed sprites, and her mother did too, and they were noble women. We grow up, searching our guardians for what is right and what is true, thinking they have all the answers, like they already understand the signs of life. But they don't. No one does. She looked away. I see how Benji is, desperate to achieve what his grandfather could not. How you are, fighting to unstitch all the lies the Abbess sewed into you. And while I am a hunter, a killer, like all Bower women, I should have looked harder at myself and less at them. There were tears in her eyes. I always hated killing sprites. They are just creatures, trying to live, like the rest of us. Maybe I never knew that until I killed the faithful forester and finally felt what a righteous kill could be like. But I kept slaughtering sprites. I might kill one now, if it came onto the road. Daylight dappled in through the trees, painting her tears gold. It's hard to see who I am when I am lost in what's expected of me. I brushed my thumb over my shroud. If it would not pain her, I'd lay my head in Maud's lap and let her tears fall onto my face, because it would cleanse something in me no spring water ever had. I hated dreaming, I said. I hated it so much, I decided I'd be perfect at it, so that no one ever knew. She faced me. Why do we do these things to ourselves?
The answer is rather simple.
The gargoyle swatted birch branches as we passed them by.
When you do the right thing for the wrong reason, no one praises you. When you do the wrong thing for the right reason, everyone does, even though what is right and wrong depends entirely on the story you're living in. And no one says they need recognition or praise or love, but we all hunger for it. We all want to be special.
That is a very keen thing to say, Gargoyle. Maud put her uninjured hand on his shoulder. How is it you came to know so much more about life than the rest of us? His chest puffed with pride.
I am years beyond my wisdom.
I smiled and did not correct him. Of all the beauty Traum held, its tors and cities and peaks and woods, none had prepared me for the splendour of its seaside. The cliffs of Belladine were a marvel. Green sweeping hills, spotted with sheep. The higher the hills reached, the more flowers lay upon them. Thrift flowers, carpets of them. If I rolled down any which one, I would be stained a brilliant shade of pink. The heart of the hamlet rested between hills, populated by dozens of crofts and houses made of stone. And just beyond them, sheer white cliffs. The glorious, sighing sea. We rode over the last finger of the Tenor River, saw the last birch trees, and then I was gasping, looking over the sea.
Oh, Bartholomew,
the gargoyle said, standing in the cart.
It's like looking out over the edge of the world.
It was. Even the knighthood, who were not new to the splendour like me, slowed their horses to look out over the hills, the cliffs, the water. Hands were put to eyes, lips pulled over teeth in smiles. Benji, who rode at the front of the line, winced against the wind. Next to him rode Rory. Only he wasn't looking out over the view. He was watching me take it all in. I let out a heavy exhale, held his gaze until I was burning. Thunder rumbled overhead. That sounds like a storm, Maud said.
Pish posh!
The gargoyle stuck his nose to the wind.
I can always smell it when it's going to rain. The thunder was but a collision of clouds.
It began to pour 20 minutes later. Always smell when it's going to rain my foot, I grumbled. Wind whipped and the horses brayed, rain pelting us from every angle, pinging over armour, ricocheting into faces. Not as wise as we think, are we? The gargoyle wrapped his wings around himself and pouted. By the time we got to the main road, to the circle of crofts, the king and his knights looked positively drowned. We reached an inn and adjoining stables.
I hate it, the gargoyle wailed against the rain. How do the flowers bear this incessant abuse?
He covered his eyes, wobbled, then fell out of the wagon into mud and thrashed. It frightened the boy who'd come to take her horses so acutely, he fled into the inn and did not come out again until his mother was with him. We took our armour off in the stables. The knights were each given a key and a room to share. When the innkeeper gave me mine, wrought iron, I noticed that she was wearing a circle around her neck, a stone with the centre carved out. Her eyes caught on my shroud, then lowered to my knightly under armour. Bless me, you're a contradiction.
Rude,
the gargoyle muttered behind me. The woman smiled. There was a web of fine wrinkles around her eyes.
Sorry, I've never been to Aisling. Never seen a diviner in the flesh.
I swallowed the knot in my throat and nodded at her necklace. Is that a loomstone? She put a wrinkled hand to her throat.
Got it practically the day I was born. We all wear one.
Again, she smiled. We're all weavers here. I waited for her to ask me about Aisling, for her to bring a piece of cloth, a thread maybe, and ask me if I saw any signs, or presages, or portents, or any which word people used when they spoke to me of the omens. She didn't. She just gave me the key to my room and smiled. They seem a gentle folk here, I said to Maud, as we passed a reaching loom, a dozen women working it. They believe in the omens as much as the others, Maud said, as we moved up the stairs. But the Heartsore Weaver is all about presages of love. Heartbreak. Both of those things tend to bring people together. I don't know. It's made folk of this hamlet strangely kind. I opened our room and led her inside. How world-weary I'd become to be surprised that an omen could have a benevolent impact over their hamlet. We're still going to kill her, I said. The Heartsore Weaver. We'll kill her, and then we'll go to Aisling. My voice hardened. I want to look the abbess in the eye before we rid Traum of its final omen.
That's all well and good, the gargoyle said from the corner of the room.
He shook a blanket at me.
But who's going to tuck me in?
Hours later, when the storm was over and the night quiet and Maud and the gargoyle snoring, a note slid under my door.
Meet at the beach.
R. The innkeeper, knighthood, everyone was in bed. I tiptoed down the stairs, past the loom, past the room with the hearth. The fire was still alight.
Six?
I turned. There were five chairs pulled near the hearth. In three of them, with large cups in their hands, sat Hamelin, Dedrick Lange, and Tory Bassett. Benji was there too, not seated, but pacing, walking back and forth in front of the others. When he saw me, he stopped mid-stride.
It is you.
His eyes traced my pale nightshirt.
Thought you might be a ghost.
I smiled. I was just thinking about you, Six, he said, debating whether or not to see if you were awake, only I didn't wish to wake Maud. She needs her rest. You can call me Sybil, you know. I came to stand next to him. What did you want me for? We're having a little meeting about tomorrow's ceremony, and what comes after. The king patted the spine of an empty chair. Please, join us. He seemed different to me. There was no wine in his hand, no liquid courage. He stood taller, spoke more clearly, as if with every hamlet we'd gone to, Benedict Castor had been fortified. Then I looked from his face into Hamelin's and the other two knights by the fire. They weren't Benji's usual company. I wondered what they knew, if they knew anything at all, or if this was just pretense. Him, making merry with his knights to keep them from learning, he was doing far more in the hamlets than participating in ceremonies. You didn't want to ask Rory to join your meeting? Dedrick Lange snorted. I did ask him, Benji said. Not 10 minutes ago, in fact. But he was on his way out the door and said he'd catch up with me later. Even in the dim light, I could see the king's smile strain. He seemed distracted.
Just as well,
Tory Bassett said, between sips of wine.
Mendacious has no sway over the hamlets or the noble families.
I frowned. What's your point?
The point,
Hamelin said, his tone pleasant but not his gaze,
is that Mendacious has nothing to bring to the table. He isn't highborn. He's brash, uncharismatic, and entirely without political value. No real use, save brute intimidation. In a word, a bad knight.
I slapped his wine out of his hand. It hit the floor, splashing upon Benji's feet, painting them crimson. Hamelin laughed, but the king silenced him. His voice was harsher than I'd ever heard it.
Careful, Benji warned. To question a knight's merit is to question the king. I may not be the scholar my grandfather was, but I've studied my knights and applied their value well enough.
His gaze narrowed over Hamelin.
Or should I reevaluate yours?
Hamelin went silent, and Benji's cheeks flushed. Whatever power he'd tasted, he clearly relished the flavour. He turned to me, spine straight.
Join us, Six. I'd like to discuss your position once we are finished in the hamlets and returned to Castle Lurik.
Then his gaze dropped to my hand and the note therein. Clouds formed in his eyes.
Or perhaps you too find yourself distracted.
Were I still Six, the diviner upon the tour, I would give him what he wanted at the price of my own pleasure. To let my shoulders sink beneath the burden of my yeses was the only way I understood my own merit. But Six was gone. I'd love to discuss tomorrow's ceremony with you, Benji, I said, shooting Hamelin a glower. But right now I'm meeting someone else. He's brash and uncharismatic and entirely without political value. The best knight I know. I left, slamming the inn door behind me. The air outside was tepid, the sky clear, and the path to the beach well marked by woven banners. I followed them, slipping between thrift flowers, basking in the pleasure of treading over dirt, then sand, with my bare feet. The sighing sea was gentle, unassuming, a low, steady rush. I stopped 20 paces onto the beach, arrested by the sight of the water. It seemed the sky, ever patient, had waited the entire day for the sea to be calm enough to touch. And now that the weather had cleared, the night sky pressed itself over the water. I could not tell where the sea ended, and the moon, the stars, began.
Storm's over,
a voice called from behind me.
It's always pretty like this afterward.
I turned. He stood in shadow, leaned up against the rock face. Rory. He looked lazy, but the nearer I drew, the more apparent the illusion. I could hear his quick inhales, see the pulse in his neck jump. We hadn't told anyone about what had passed between us at Petula Hall. We hadn't spoken of it ourselves, but it was there between us. Every time we looked at each other, brushed hands, breathed the same air, it was there. Rory's fingers flexed.
Come here.
I was on him, shoving him against the wall of rocks and kissing him. He grasped the nape of my neck, anchoring our mouths together. I like that you're a bad knight, I said, pressing my teeth into his bottom lip. It's what makes you a good one. Rory reached for my face, took off my shroud. When it fell away, I couldn't bear the reverence that flickered through his eyes. It scared me, thrilled me so much that I wrestled him to the ground, and we went at one another so roughly they must have heard us in the village. Must have known it wasn't just the sea, crashing and moaning, after the storm.